18364CV, Low Income Consumers, Mary Wilson, Ippolita Lutz, and the Public Utility Commission of the State of Texas.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. This case will have implications for the more than half a million low-income customers who previously received protections that the Public Utility Commission of Texas tries to do away with today. These protections include a split deposit, late fee penalty waiver, and a deferred payment plan, and are essential to low-income customers' access to and choice within the retail electric market here in Texas. Today, I'll talk to you about how the PUC in Project 47343 violated the Administrative Procedures Act, public notice and comment with respect to the split deposit rule, and reason justification requirements with respect to all three rules. Mr. Hall will be arguing on behalf of the City of Houston to address how the PUC in this project also exceeded its statutory authority. If the court does not agree that the rules are invalid, as Mr. Hall will argue, we're asking this court to remand the rules back to the PUC and with respect to the split deposit rule, to ask the PUC to re-engage the public notice and comment section as well.
Don't we have to get to that first, though? Isn't that the primary issue before us?
I believe there's two issues before you, Your Honor. The first is whether or not the PUC exceeded its statutory authority, with which Mr. Hall will cover,
okay. And
also whether the PUC was not in keeping with the APA,
okay. With
the reason justification requirements. In December 2017, the PUC initiated Project 47343, and the purpose was to update its rules to remove references to the System Benefit Fund. The System Benefit Fund previously provided for a bill payment assistance program and reduced rates for low-income consumers, and disbursement from that fund ended in 2017. Importantly, the rules before the court today were never funded by the System Benefit Fund, and REPs, or retail electric providers, were never provided reimbursements under the System Benefit Fund. These existed completely separate and distinct from the System Benefit Fund, which was in subchapter Q, whereas the protections existed in subchapter R.
So are you saying that for all three, the splitting of the deposits, the late penalty waivers, and the deferred payment plans, none of that was reimbursed through the SBF?
That's correct.
Were they reimbursed through anything else?
No, my understanding is that they weren't. And the basis for that is provided in former rule 39.903 B and E, which provided for the System Benefit Fund.
Okay.
Senate Bill 1976 was passed on September 1st, 2017, as a way of providing for the ability of REPs to continue providing protections and services to low-income customers. SB 1976 explains that REPs are not required to offer certain benefits for which they will not receive reimbursement. This is codified in Section 17.007 sub C of the Utilities Code and is also provided in the handouts. What SB 1976 did not do is articulate or suggest that the PUC should eliminate important and long-standing customer protections that had been on the books for many years. In addition, SB 1976 does not even mention the customer protections in Chapter 17 that the PUC ultimately did away with in Project 47343. Unfortunately, the PUC misread SB 1976 to say that it had to eliminate customer protections for low-income customers if and when a REP may incur some costs. It's important to note that REPs incur costs for all kinds of things that the PUC did not address. For instance, payment assistance programs, rules related to disconnection of electric service during extreme weather events, on weekends and holidays, or for certain customers. REPs are required to waive deposits entirely for certain customers, including seniors and victims of family violence. The REPs are not going to be reimbursed today, and they were never reimbursed for these costs. In eliminating the split deposit rule, the late fee penalty waiver, and the deferred payment plan, the PUC violated the APA's public notice and comment with respect to the split deposit rule only, and reason justification provisions with respect to all three. The stated purpose of the APA is to provide for public participation in the rulemaking process. The APA requires an agency like the PUC to provide public notice, an opportunity for and full consideration of comments, and most importantly, a reason justification for the rule enacted. The reason justification must include, in the order, a summary of comments received, why the agency disagrees with the comments, and a factual basis for the rule. So there must be a rational connection between the factual basis of the rule and the rule as adopted. There was no reason justification for any of the adopted rules. The former split deposit rule.
Well, the justification was because since the SBF was going to no longer be around, they wanted to clear up anything that referred to it, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So let me ask you specifically on Rule 25.478E3, which is the one that deals with the splitting of the deposits. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it specifically entitle or talk about the customers who qualify under the program under 25.454, which has been deleted?
It does.
So let's assume that we were to agree with your notice argument that they didn't notice, at least for this section, correctly. And that 25.478E3 stays the same. How would that provide anybody any benefit if they have to qualify under a section that is no longer in existence?
And I do agree that the purpose of the project was to eliminate references to the System Benefit Fund, which is exactly what they tried to do. However, there is nothing that says that they couldn't maintain this protection for low-income customers in another way. So I don't agree that it was improper for them to eliminate the reference to the rate reduction program, I believe, under this. But there are other ways that that low-income customers could still benefit from this after the elimination of the System Benefit Fund.
And on the notice question, I mean, how is the statement that they're going to remove reference to the SBF, how is that not some notice that people are going to be affected, these low-income consumers are going to be affected because this is going to be deleted, specifically on the split deposit part?
So in the initial notice, the commission was actually considering expanding the split deposit to all customers. And because the System Benefit Fund never provided for the split deposit rule, I don't believe that customers, low-income customers specifically, or even the customers that were interested parties in the case and submitted comments, were on notice that the rule would be eliminated entirely.
So what is the relationship between 39903 of the Texas Utility Code and 25.478E3?
So the first provision was previously the System Benefit Fund. That was eliminated in 2013.
Correct.
And then the legislature allowed for disbursements to continue in 2015 through 2017 because there was still money left in the fund.
Okay, so under Rule 25.454, which specifically talks about the System Benefit Fund, and I'm just calling it SBF for short, my question, and I'm not sure that I understood your answer to it, is let's assume we leave 25.478E3 just like it is, not deleted. How does that provide anybody with any kind of help if it states the customer or applicant who qualifies for the rate reduction program under 25.454 of this title?
Right. The way that the current rule exists, because it only makes reference to the rate reduction program, which is how low-income customers were identified under the SBF, wouldn't achieve the goal of maintaining these protections for low-income customers. That's right. However, Chapter 17 and 39 make it clear that the PUC has the authority to adopt rules that will uphold the customer protection standards for everybody, but also for low-income customers.
So are y'all arguing that they would have to come up with a different rule other than 25.478?
What we're arguing is that the elimination of the reference to the SBF in the split deposit rule was something that the PUC was mandated to do. But eliminating the protection for low-income customers, or failing to explain to low-income customers that they should participate in the rulemaking process was not in keeping with the APA.
But when I look at some of the responsive comments in the order in this project number, it seems clear, and I haven't had a chance to look at everything yet, but it seems clear that people understood that this was going to be affecting low-income consumers. So, well.
May I respond?
Sure.
So the two main parties, interested parties that submitted comments against the expansion of the split deposit rule, ARM and TEAM,
right,
actually never advocated for the elimination of
They advocated for expansion of it and inclusion of the split deposit for everybody, which there was information that came in that said we can't, or you know, that shouldn't be the rule, if I remember the order correctly.
ARM and TEAM were arguing against the expansion of the rule. TLSC and Texas Rose, and I think the Office of Public Utility Counsel were arguing for the expansion.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. For the record, my name is Alton Hall, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the City of Houston, an intervener in this appeal. The city has intervened in this appeal for one important purpose, and that is the protection of low-income consumers. That is an issue that's very near and dear to the heart of the mayor and the city as a whole. In fact, Mayor Turner, as you I'm sure know, served almost 20 years in the state legislature. And during that time, he was one of the drafters and a staunch supporter of the System Benefit Fund, and therefore is very familiar with this legislation. In deciding to get involved in this issue, certainly we looked at all sides of this. And the way that we see this, as we set forth in our brief, is that the fundamental issue before this court, before you even get to the APA issues, is whether or not the Texas legislature, in adopting SB 1976, codified as 17.007, when it discontinued certain benefits to reps, to low-income consumers by reps, without reimbursement, intended by doing that to also abolish customer protections that are set forth in the rules that you were just discussing with my colleague, namely 25.47A8E3, 25.480H1, and 25.480J, which of course address the split deposits, the late penalty waiver fee, the late penalty fee waivers, and also the deferred payment plans. That is the issue. If, in fact, the legislature did not intend to abolish those customer protections, then the PUC has exceeded its authority. And that is what we are asserting in this case.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Hall? So what authority allows a PUC to keep the benefits in place when the SBF expired? Obviously, it can't be the SBF. Under what authority, separate authority, does the PUC have?
Well, the PUC has separate authority to have customer protections and customer benefits. And in fact, if you look at Texas Utility Code 17.004, which is part of the attachments in the exhibit that you got from the low-income consumers, the appellants, that grants the authority to implement rules for customer protection, such as what we're talking about here today.
Do you also believe that under the PC's general rulemaking authority that they can pass these rules?
Yes, absolutely so. I think that they're granted some broad discretion in certain instances, as long as it's consistent with the governing legislation. And in this instance, there is no legislation that stated the contrary. And as I'll address in a moment, SB 1976 did not mandate that the PUC eliminate these protections. In fact, I think it's quite clear when you look at the legislation itself, 17.007C, it talks about what is to be eliminated. Nowhere does it mention customer split deposits. Nowhere does it mention late payment fee waivers. Nowhere does it mention deferred payment plans. The only words that the PUC has grappled upon and seized upon is other benefits. And as we laid out in our brief, and unfortunately, if I had more time, I would get into it in more detail, but I only have 5 minutes. As the PUC laid out, as we laid out in our brief, its benefits and protections are clearly different. As my counsel identified, one is under subchapter Q, which is benefits. Customer protections of subchapter R. And what's extremely important here is that the customer protections were never intended to be reimbursed, and they were never reimbursed. Why? Because they were never considered to be a benefit that was being provided out of pocket by the reps.
Well, how do you reconcile 17007C with 17004B? They both talk about bill payment assistance. Under 004, it says you can do it. Under 007, it says you can't do it and not provide for reimbursement. How do we reconcile those two?
Well, and this gets back to the point. I see my time is up. May I respond?
Yes.
This gets back to the point that when you're talking about benefits, you're talking about out-of-pocket costs to the rep. If you look at what's considered benefits under SB 1976, 17.007C, those are all out-of-pocket. When you're talking about protections, you're not talking about out-of-pocket. So even though you're talking about bill assistance,
Can you give me a concrete
yes.
example
well,
of what bill
okay.
payment assistance would look like under a benefit versus under a protection?
Certainly. Under a benefit, it would be where you're actually paying the bill for the customer.
Okay.
You're actually providing a discount. There's something where the rep
Correct.
Is somehow disadvantaged
okay.
by doing it. Whereas under customer service protection, you're not. Essentially, you may be talking about timing, but you're not talking about whether they're going to get paid. It's a question of when. For example, deferred payment plans, all of the three that we mentioned, those are situations where they may not get paid the first month, the deposit, but they'll get paid over 2 months. With the deferred payment plan, they may not get paid all of it the first month, but it may be over a three-month period, but they will get paid. And so those are totally different animals. And even with regard to the late payment fee waiver, that's not something that's part of the cost of the service. That's an additional fee that you know they normally wouldn't even have a right to. So that's not a situation where they're out of pocket. So that's the distinction that has been made, and I think it is the valid one. And nowhere in SB 1976 is there language that would suggest that the court intended to cover the protections as I've laid them out versus those out-of-pocket benefits.
You mean the legislature?
Yes.
Okay, not the court.
I'm sorry if I said the court. I meant the legislature.
That's okay.
I'm hoping the court will agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to begin first by addressing that question that you had asked, Justice Triana, about the bill payment assistance. I think it's helpful to know that in the rules right now, the only thing that the PUC requires is that a bill payment assistant exists, but it only exists if it's based on customer donations. And so I think that's sort of that's what the PUC is allowed to do given 17.007C's restriction. They can set a minimum. Anyway, I just wanted to, I had looked at that myself and thought it was interesting and helpful.
Well, not to start off by asking a question, but I'm going to anyway, since we're there.
Sure.
How do you reconcile 17007C with 17004B?
Just as I said, so the bill payment assistant program, as it exists in rules now, the only thing that a PUC requires a rep to have is a bill payment assistance program that's based on customer donations. So there's no cost. So it doesn't count as a benefit that's not reimbursed. And so it is a protection without cost, if that makes sense. Because it is the minimum that the PUC has set is it's based on customer donations. They have not required reps to provide more than that.
But what about affordable rate packages? I mean, it's 17004 sounds like
sure.
Very much like the SBF that
yes.
you can do the SBF
yes.
or something that looks like the SBF.
Yes.
Or this is so.
Yes. So the 17.004 provision you're citing relates to the things that must be provided. It's the only part in statute that says these are protections that must be provided. And it's weatherization energy efficiency services, it's the affordable rate package, which was part of the system benefit fund subsidy, and the bill payment assistance programs. So when the PUC rolled out the rate reduction program in order to effectuate these mandated programs, they added these extra programs or perks or benefits of a split deposit, late fee waiver, deferred payment plan. Because there's no statute that says these three programs are protections. They were sort of add-ons by the PUC. In fact, they were added to the rate reduction program after that program was created.
Okay, so it states that they can go ahead and electric utility relating to customer deposits and extension of credit and switching fees. I mean, there's quite a laundry list. It's not just
yes.
three things that they can do. So why would that not allow what the appellants are arguing, allow the PUC to do that?
Yes. So what's important here is the legislature's done two things. They ended the system benefit fund, and by virtue of that, this rate reduction program. And they also passed SB 1976. And in SB 1976, they have this restriction, but they also made the identification process of a low-income customer class completely voluntary. And so the PUC is not in a position to say, oh, you need to continue to provide these benefits, these late fee waivers, split deposits to low-income customers, but we can't require you to find out who those people are. And if you're a customer that receives Medicaid or SNAP, that's private information. That's not publicly available. And so when the legislature made that change, turned what was once a mandatory process, identifying uniformly this class of customers into a voluntary one, they indicated that, hey, we want this. We no longer want the PUC mandating these programs. We want this to be handled by the competitive market. And so it was a policy choice made by the legislature, which the PUC then had to implement in its rules. And that's what it did here. It acted within the limitations set upon it by the legislature, which was get rid of this fund, get rid of this program. Oh, and we are not creating a requirement that retail electric providers are notified who their low-income customers are. So the PUC is not in a position to recreate that program. That would be, in fact, contrary to what the legislature has told it to do.
Well, okay, so but do you agree that no one, I think I saw this in Houston's briefing, but no one really told anyone, hey, we're going to delete these programs in their entirety. I think that was Houston that pointed that out to us.
The notice.
Yeah.
On the first page of the notice, the PUC says we're going to repeal these rules. And listed in that list of repealed rules is the split deposit rule. It is said we are not just updating,
it
we are repealing.
Cessation of the system benefit fund as required and updating language to remove references to the system benefit fund. It doesn't really say, but we're going to completely obliterate these other programs that have been in existence in the past.
Actually, if you look in at the PUC's notice, and it's item B, it actually says in the very beginning, it lists a series of rules that are going to,
right.
again, be repealed.
Right.
And so that is explicitly stated that this is part of a repeal.
So there's a section that says, as a notice, we're going to repeal this section, and then there's another part of the notice that says, as to this section, we're going to just strike out this language that makes it for everybody?
So what happened was they announced that the system benefit fund is going away. We're going to repeal all these things that are related to it. In the instance of the split deposit, when they went through and removed those references, there was still text available. There
Correct.
Was still a rule
Correct.
They could put
Correct.
Forward. But what that rule became was, instead of being limited to low-income customers, it became a whole new rule. It was split deposits for everyone.
Correct.
So the PUC naturally asked, with 17.007C's restriction, is this going to violate this new limitation we have? And solicited comments on that to find out, will this expansion eliminate? Ratepayer organizations, industry, they all participate in the rulemaking. They're having the dialogue they're supposed to have. Industry provided cost estimates. The PUC considered this evidence and realized, yes, this will, if we expand this, this will violate this statutory provision. Now, because the rate reduction program is gone and there's no means of identifying customers for that program, there's no middle ground for the PUC to go back to. It was either we remove those references, the rule's been expanded to everyone. Oh, we can't do that without violating statute. We have to get rid of it completely. And so that's what happened.
So you believe you can give notice, sort of like a general notice and a specific notice, and kind of pick which one you want to go to, a specific statute?
A specific rule? The standard for notice and what case law provides is that the Texas Supreme Court understands that the final rule will be somewhat different than the proposed rule. And what the test is whether or not this final rule is a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule. And as I've mentioned, there was a dialogue about this. And so this final version of the rule is a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule. Now, appellants argue.
Are you talking about like the patient's advocate holdings?
Patient advocates and Deffenbach cases,
okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellants argue, well, during that dialogue, during that agency rulemaking, there wasn't a single comment that advocated for the removal of the split deposit. But that's not the standard. There is no case law that says a specific comment must be made advocating a specific change in order for the agency to make that change. The PUC has the expertise. It's conducting this rulemaking. It can make that decision.
I agree, but going back to the notice, are you advocating that you can give two notices? The PUC could theoretically say, we're either going to, you know, expand this or get rid of it completely, and that would satisfy the notice requirement under rulemaking authority?
Again, the notice in here, the first notice that was issued in the Texas Public Register, instead, we were repealing this rule as part of this update. Again, when we went through and updated these rules, this split deposit, there was enough language in it for it to remain on the books. And so we're going to talk about whether or not we need to solicit comments to find out whether or not this will violate this new statute. And so there was dialogue about if
this new
rule.
I'm not talking about the dialogue. I'm talking about the notice. Are you saying that the notice was just purely about deleting it, and there was no notice given saying that they were going to expand it, and that just came through the comments later on?
There is the notice.
Correct.
And the notice on the first page says we are going to repeal, we're removing the system benefit fund, we're removing all references, we're going to repeal this series of rules, including split deposit rule. Then when they provided the proposed rules, they could do so without eliminating the rule in its entirety. So there is we're repealing in the notice, and then this is what we have left when we remove those references. It's sort of it's almost a technical, whoever went through and was striking the language, there was enough language there for something to remain.
Okay, but in the language, they went ahead and did something different than what they noticed.
Yes.
Which was, we're going to expand this.
Yes, and they solicited comments on that change.
Correct. And once again, the position is that that is okay. You can have a notice that's a general notice saying, we're getting rid of this, and by the way, this is what it looks like, and that's not comports to what we told you we were doing. This comports to something totally different.
Again, it's a proposed rule.
Right.
And so again, that first paragraph is letting everyone know, and the test for notice, again, is logical outgrowth and whether or not new parties or new issues are implicated. This rulemaking was always about split, in relation to split deposit, it remained about split deposit. Something was going to happen to the split deposit. And the first page of the notice said, we're going to repeal it. Here's our proposed version. In this case, it expands it. Then again, rulemaking is this iterative process. They had the conversations they're supposed to have. They can't reinstate the rate reduction program. They have to remove it. It was always about the split deposit. Part of rulemaking is that things are going to change.
Let me ask you the question I asked Mr. Hall. Do you believe that the PUC, they don't have under their general rulemaking authority, they cannot create a low-income program?
Given what the legislature has done here, they are not with how a low-income customer class that this no longer can be mandatory, the PUC is limited. It is a limitation set upon it by the legislature, a policy choice by the legislature. And in fact, in this rulemaking record, we do have a letter from the bill sponsor saying just that.
Well, and this is all, not all, but this is primarily relying upon the reading of 17007C and the
this, what is, can you just tell what this is?
Yeah. The language in 17007C where it says that the commission cannot require retail electrical providers to put all these things out there or other benefits for which the provider or utility is not reimbursed. That language there, if we agree with, say, the City of Houston's assessment of whether or not y'all properly relied upon that section, is that dispositive of this appeal, or is there still stuff that we can do up here?
There, that would be limited to the split deposit.
Mm-hmm.
It would not affect the other issues.
Okay.
If that's, I believe that's what you're asking. And I think, again, it's important to remember 17.007C, the cost was only for the proposed expansion of the split deposit rule, that that didn't come into play for the other two programs' benefits.
So you agree that the 1976 does not come into play for the other two, the deferred payment and...
It does in the sense of that identifying a customer class. It, the PUC cannot tell reps now or retail electric providers that you need to offer late fee waivers to low-income customers because they have no means of identifying who the low-income customer is for retail electric providers. Again, it would...
Because SBF has been...
has been gone. The process by which those customers were identified has been gone, and in fact, the legislature has said, PUC, you can only create that list if retail electric providers ask for it. So there is a clear move to, we want retail electric providers to decide if they want this information.
Okay, so you're not arguing that 17007C prevents the PUC from requiring the REPs to do a, not the deposit, but to do a deferred payment and to do... What's the third one that we're talking about?
Late fee.
And late fee.
Late fee.
Is that correct?
It did. During the rulemaking, that was not the basis for the PUC's decision. During the rulemaking, what had happened was when PUC went through and removed those references, there was no language left. They just could just flat out remove it because this rate reduction program is gone. The ratepayer organization said, well, we'd like to, we don't like this policy, which is, again, coming from the legislature, we don't like this policy that this program is going away. We'd like to instead expand these programs to everyone. The PUC is not, that was not what this rulemaking was initiated for. It was beyond the scope of the rulemaking, and which is what the PUC wrote in its order.
And so do you agree with Ms. Heaps that originally, the REPs, they were never getting reimbursed for any of these, that for the deposits, split deposits, late penalty waivers, or deferred payment plans?
You're right. They were not being reimbursed. But whether or not a rep was reimbursed for these programs based on how the mechanics of this expired program work do not matter in the context of what 17.007C is today.
But doesn't it matter under the reason justification? If the reason justification for the rules are that we're getting rid of, since we have no longer have the SBF, we need to kind of clean up the rules because of that, wouldn't it matter then?
For them to cite...
If that's the reason justification that what we're doing, then how do you get rid of the late penalty waivers and the deferred payment plans?
When you look at the, and this is pretty ticky-tacky, but when you look at what the rule was that the PUC was amending for the late fee waiver and for the deferred payment plan, essentially the rule read something, the following customers can get a deferred payment. Subsection A, customers in getting a light-up discount in the rate reduction program. So when they're amending those rules, they can't leave it a customer. They just went through the whole reference. There was nothing that remained in that rule. And so the reason justification is these programs have gone away. We remove that class of customers that receive that benefit.
So that goes to the question that I was asking Ms. Heaps. If we go back under the notice to putting 25,478 just the way it was, then how does that help her clients if we're just referring to a list that's under 25,454 that doesn't exist?
Yes. It was, these benefits, perks, programs were based wholly on whether or not you qualified for a program which no longer exists. I think one point I'd like to touch on is that I think is crucial to this case is there's no statute that characterizes these programs as protections. The only statutes that appellants rely on, and they're the four different statutes, they are all general statutes granting PUC the authority to set rules. And what those four statutes, and it's 17.001B, 17.004A, 04B, and 39.101E, what all of those statutes highlight is that it's within the PUC's purview to set minimum customer service standards and which ones are necessary. And here, that's what the PUC did. It did so in response to the legislative directive that it had received, that directive being programs ending. We want the competitive market to take care of these customers. We want reps to compete for the business of low-income customers. The PUC is operating within that environment, and the rulemaking that they initiated and completed comports with that. Now, without any statutory support, the court can look to how the PUC referred to these programs, these benefits. They were the ones, the PUC created them in the first place. And if you look at the former rate reduction program rule, it refers to these late fee waivers, the split deposit as benefits within the text of the rule. Late penalty waiver benefits, deposit installment benefits. Again, all three were based on whether or not you were enrolled in this program that no longer exists. And presumably, when the legislature enacted SB 1976, it did so knowing how the PUC treated these programs, that it viewed them as benefits of the rate reduction program, and that's why it incorporated that language in the statute. Appellants ignore how these rules, the rules themselves, characterize these rules, and instead they rely on dictionary definitions and, frankly, definitions of their own creation. We don't need that here because what appellants need to show is that the PUC was unreasonable in its interpretation, and it's not. The PUC, again, is responding to what the legislature has instructed it to do. And as I've mentioned several times, the PUC cannot reinstate the rate reduction program. It cannot create a new way to identify low-income customers without violating SB 1976 or, in fact, doing so with... In what sense? Because the reason this rulemaking was initiated, the agency initiates rulemaking in response to the expiration of this program. It has to show why it's doing this. It wasn't in a position, it did not have authority to expand any of these programs or to create a new program out of whole cloth. It was in the position of...
So do I understand that basically the only reason it had the ability to make these programs before is because SBF existed?
Yes.
I don't understand under 17.004B how that can be.
Because those three things listed, the energy... the weatherization services, bill payment assistance, and affordable rate package, those are specific things. The affordable rate package was the subsidized rates provided by the system benefit fund.
Okay, but there's more than three. We're talking about the commission may adopt and enforce rules as necessary or appropriate to carry out this section, including rules for minimum service standards, retail or an electric utility relating to customer deposits, and the extension of credit, the switching of fees, the levelizing of billing programs, the termination of service, and to energy efficient programs, an affordable rate package, and a bill payment assistance program for low income. How are you reading just three things in there?
What's important there is that it's within the PUC's authority. The PUC may adopt rules as necessary to enforce these things.
Correct.
There's nothing that's requiring them to. And so there is no authority requiring the PUC to have split deposits, late fee waivers, or deferred payment plans.
I understand that, but I thought that your comment to Justice Goodwin is they couldn't do it even if they wanted to, because once 1976 passed, they were not able to. And my question is, I agree with your just comment you just made, which is yes, they could if they wanted to under this. So do you agree they could or they can't?
They cannot do it for low-income customers because of that SB 1976 saying, PUC, you cannot develop a list, you cannot obtain this private information from the Health and Human Services Commission identifying who counts as a low-income consumer and require reps to get that information. You can't, there's nothing that's preventing reps from requesting this information.
Is there, so there's a definition of low-income customers. Where did I miss that?
There's a definition within Chapter 17 and Chapter 39, and it was list. It was
okay. Yeah, so it's in our stuff.
Okay. Yes, of what counts as a low income electric consumer.
I got so caught up in the 400 page order that.
If there are any other questions,
I do. So okay. I'm sorry, and I'm just trying to understand. So your argument is, the PUC under 1704 has the power to make rules that comply and protect customers, just not low-income customers.
The 17.004, there is a protection. Low-income consumers are protected from discrimination. These three programs do not impact whether or not a customer is discriminated against based on low income, on their low-income status. And so the PUC has the authority to set minimum customer standards. They get to determine what those standards are. In this case, where there was a program that identified a uniform class of customers across the industry, the PUC could require additional programs. When the legislature met in 2017 and said, this fund is ending, the rate reduction program's ending, and we don't want the PUC to set regulatory mandates on the industry anymore. We want reps to compete for the business of low-income customers. And so they turned what was a consistent way for the industry to identify who their low-income customers were. They took that away, or didn't take it away. They made it voluntary. And so they put the power of serving low-income customers, they took it away from the PUC and said, we want the market to handle this. And so that's where we are today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So first I wanted to start with the public notice itself, because it's something that the appellee spent a lot of time on. And I want to just clarify, it does not say that the PUC is going to repeal the split deposit, late fee penalty waiver, or the deferred payment plan. It says it's going to repeal subchapter Q, which again is the SBF. And it says it's going to amend and update language in the rules that are before the court today, so I just wanted to make that clear as well. In addition, the only question on which the PUC solicited comment was, what are the specific costs to reps with respect to expanding the split deposit rule to everyone? Ms. Davis mentioned that sometimes rules change and morph as rulemaking proceedings go on. And I believe she said that if it's a logical outgrowth, that's appropriate. Here we have an outright elimination. I don't think that this is a logical outgrowth. And the patient advocate's case that she cited says, a rule that significantly changes the issues involved in the rulemaking process, raises new subjects, and likely affects different persons than those previously given notice. And that's exactly what we're arguing, is that low-income customers were not given appropriate notice and could not meaningfully participate in an informed way. The case continues, therefore, when new subjects of regulation or persons besides those previously given notice are affected, proper notice requires republication of the proposed rule. So here, the logical outgrowth is really tantamount to an elimination, which I don't think that the case law provides. In addition, she talked about how the System Benefit Fund provided for these protections. So the protections came about, I believe it was the 76th legislature. This was after the electric market in Texas deregulated, and this is how we got reps in the first place. So the customer protections were put in place in order to maintain these minimum protection standards while this competition was happening. This preceded the System Benefit Fund, which took effect in 2005. So the protections actually predated the System Benefit Fund. And in fact, with respect to the protections, so the the elimination of the System Benefit Fund, we wouldn't have had 1976. So 1976 was in direct response to that. It didn't provide for the PUC's authority or suggest that the PUC should eliminate protections as well.
Can you, Ms. Heaps, can you point me to the where I can find the language of the notice as well as the language of the reasoned justifications in the record?
Yes. So the I'll start with the reasoned justifications, if that's okay.
Sure.
So this is in AR item 46. And on pages 40 and 41, it shows the commission's conclusory statements for not expanding the split deposit rule. On pages 43 and 46, you see the commission's conclusion that expanding the late deposit fee waiver is beyond the scope of the rulemaking. And then on page 48, you have the commission's conclusion that expanding the deferred payment plan is beyond the scope of the rulemaking.
Okay.
And then the proposed rules are located at, I'm sorry, that's the former rules. The proposed rules can be found at AR item 35. And it's pages 3 and 4 that show the question that was posed regarding the split deposit rule, how the proposed rule would have expanded the split deposit to all, and then it also has the preamble language that we keep talking about repeal versus amend.
And so where's the notice that we were talking about, the general notice that we were getting rid of the SBF language?
That should appear on the very first page, Your Honor, of AR item 35, because those were the rules as published in the Texas Register that I'm looking at.
Thank you.
In addition, I'd also like to talk about, there are many projects in which the PUC discussed the importance of maintaining the split deposit. Probably the most important and the strongest evidence that the split deposit rule should survive the elimination of the SBF was Project 31417, which the PUC initiated in response to the elimination of the System Benefit Fund. In addition, in Project 25360, the PUC found that the ability for low-income customers to pay deposits and installments was consistent with its obligation to protect its customers.
And tell me the first project.
I'm sorry?
31417.
Sorry.
31417.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything else, Tom?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your patience with that. Boy, that's one heck of an order. With that, the case will be submitted. And if you want to, as you gather up your things, if we can get